I've never seen, in my 20 years of experience, I've never seen anything quite like this before.
A new diagnosis for the goo that was discovered near Kivalina. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, August 18th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, walrus are hauling out on Alaska's north coast, but not in big numbers.
We kind of expected them to be hauling out in greater numbers by this time.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
And by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
The orangey goo that gunked up Kivalina's shores earlier this month was first thought to be some kind of microscopic egg. But now, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration researchers say it's actually the spores of a plant fungus. Steve Morton identified the stuff. He's the research oceanographer with NOAA in South Carolina. Morton says he used high-powered electron microscopes to get a closer look and was surprised by what he found.
It's an unusual event for sure. We've never seen a mass fungal spore release like this, but we personally do not do the toxicity testing on fungi.
So you're not going to do any toxicity testing?
We just don't have the toxin standards and the techniques, but places like the USDA or CDC or actually the Alaska Department of Environmental Control may be able to run toxicity tests. If there's any type of concern for public health, these rust type of fungi, unlike other types of fungi, infect only plants. Airborne spores, however, can contribute to respiratory diseases and allergy reactions in some people.
Is it unusual that such a massive amount of these fungi were found floating in the water?
I've never seen in my 20 years of experience, I've never seen anything quite like this before.
What type of research will you be continuing with? There were close to 8,000 types of fungi. Are you going to try to identify if this is one of them?
Actually, that's beyond my area of expertise. What I'm an expert in is the taxonomy of small microscopic plants, or also called phytoplankton. So this is way outside of my field. It's even out a different kingdom of life, so it's way beyond what I could actually do. In fact, I have friends that are mycologists or people that study fungi, and without more information, they can only determine that it's a rust fungi, and that's all they can even do. And they're specialists in fungi.
You know, the area in which the spores were found honestly doesn't have a whole lot of plants. You know, there's no trees. There's grass, I guess.
Right, but there are fungi on any type of plants that are actually found in the tundra, and most of them are not really identified yet. So this may be a new species. That's way beyond my area of expertise. To actually ID this down to species, you have to have more information than what I actually have besides just the spore. You actually need what the host plant actually is too.
Steve Morton is a NOAA researcher in South Carolina. The old slogan, Alaska, North to the Future, was once considered wishful thinking, but now it's coming true. With the growing importance of the Arctic as a potential mineral transportation and maybe even fishery resource, the nation's only Arctic state is getting more attention in the foreign policy area. That was made clear in an Anchorage speech by a senior State Department official today. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
Some Americans may still think of Alaska as isolated and off the map somewhere, but if you're the top U.S. diplomat working on ocean and polar affairs, it's where all the action is. Julie Gourley is the senior Arctic official in the State Department, and she gave a speech sponsored by the civic groups Commonwealth North and the Institute of the North as part of a week-long series. She mostly talked about the Arctic Council, an organization formed by all the nations that actually have territory in the Arctic. The Council is best known for its 2004 Arctic Climate Impact Assessment, which drew political fire in the U.S. for pointing to human activities as the main cause for a warming climate that was predicted to hit the Arctic harder and sooner than the rest of the world. The Bush administration did not put much emphasis on national involvement in the Arctic Council, but Gourley says that attitude has changed under Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who was the first foreign minister from the U.S. to attend one of its meetings.
Secretary Clinton is very, very interested in the Arctic, and she was thrilled to be there. And it was a very powerful, high-level delegation, and I think we won't hear any complaints that the U.S. isn't serious about the Arctic anymore. At least I hope not.
This is Julia Gourley's fourth trip to Alaska, and there will be plenty more. She outlined a long list of initiatives either underway or being considered by the Council. The State Department is going to want to know what Arctic issues were important to the people of Alaska.
One place we're going to look for ideas and advice is the state of Alaska. We're going to be very interested in hearing what Alaska thinks as our piece of the Arctic would be important for us to emphasize.
This year's meeting of the Arctic Council yielded an agreement on coordinating search and rescue activities across the entire top of the globe. An international assessment of the cryosphere, snow, water, ice, and permafrost is underway, and an agreement on an Arctic observatory of ecosystem measurements that will be taken at agreed-upon points and times across the region. There's been a biodiversity study underway, and surprisingly, so far it shows little loss of biodiversity despite a melting Arctic. The Council also put scientists to work studying things that warm the climate other than carbon dioxide, like methane, ozone, and black carbon, in other words, soot and smoke. Black carbon is now being taken up in the United Nations as a potential international treaty subject, using the model of the Persistent Organic Pollutants Treaty that internationally limits the emissions of a number of toxic chemicals. They are hoping to bypass the kind of controversy efforts to curb carbon dioxide emissions have prompted. Maybe this is something people can agree on regardless of how they feel about greenhouse gases.
You know, I don't think anyone in the United States government wants to ignore that there are things we can do outside that the framework convention. So this was an opportunity to see if we can take some action that hopefully, if we all work together and domestically take action, will buy us some time in slowing down the melting of the cryosphere. And the science is still very much out there. It's not unified at all. There's a lot of scientific uncertainty with the impacts of black carbon in the Arctic. But this work was very important to bringing it into the public debate and to energizing the scientific community to look a little bit more closely at the impacts of black carbon.
Other areas of work ahead for the Arctic Council are looking at food and water security in the region, the need for ports, airstrips, and other transportation infrastructure, and maybe a treaty on mercury. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
The federal agency overseeing offshore petroleum drilling says it has corrected flaws in environmental work done ahead of a 2008 lease sale in the Chukchi Sea. Environmental and Alaskan Native groups disagree, saying the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management still has not addressed crucial information gaps, such as how to clean up a spill in ice-choked waters. The groups are appealing to Interior Secretary Ken Salazar to delay proposed drilling by Shell Oil and others in the Chukchi. The federal agency today released a final supplemental environmental review and said it addresses concerns raised by a federal judge in July of 2010. The federal agency held public hearings in Alaska communities and received more than 360,000 comments, letters, or cards. Walrus have started hauling out on shore along Alaska's north coast. The sea ice has retreated far north of the continental shelf, leaving the animals with limited options for foraging. But only a handful of walrus have come to shore so far this year. Chad Jay is a walrus biologist with the United States Geological Survey. His team put 40 tags on walrus last month, and he's now monitoring their movements.
The walruses seem to be going in different directions, looking for a place to haul out. Some have succeeded in finding some sea ice to the west, and others look like they're still kind of wandering around.
In late summer of last year, 20 to 30,000 walrus hauled out on barrier islands a few miles from the village of Point Lay. Last year, the animals didn't begin arriving in large numbers until late August. But with the sea ice coverage so low this summer, Jay says he's surprised more walrus haven't hauled out on land in Alaska.
This is still kind of a new phenomenon for the walruses. It remains to be seen if we start to see a more consistent pattern here in the future. So you know, I don't know if the walruses are still just a little confused and not quite sure where to go or haul out, or if they're going to end up just streaming to the south and not really hauling out very much at all.
Jay and colleagues are planning to put more radio tags on walrus near Point Lake next week. They're tracking the animals to learn more about their foraging behavior. They want to compare how their feeding behavior changes when they're forced to haul out on land instead of on the sea ice. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, two more rural papers get a second chance with a new owner.
I'm very concerned about some of the social issues facing Alaska, and I think there's a need that those issues be covered by local journalists.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
Checks are going out now to hundreds of victims of clerical sexual abuse in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta and the Greater Northwest region. The payout is one of the largest in the Catholic abuse scandal that's reached nearly every corner of the nation. Parties on both sides of the case say now it's time to move on. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson reports.
In total, more than 500 victims of abuse at the hands of Jesuit priests and volunteers will now receive a portion of the $163 million settlement. Attorney Ken Rosa is representing over 200 of the victims in Alaska, most of whom are Yupik Eskimos who were abused as children decades ago in remote villages of western Alaska.
For many of them, it's an opportunity to move on, to try to piece their lives back together. And they will have some compensation, not nearly in any sense what their claims were really worth.
Rosa declined to say how much individual victims will be receiving. That will be decided by a two-person panel, which was chosen by a committee of abuse survivors.
They got what there was to be had of the Jesuits' assets, which is certainly something.
Rosa contests that by filing for bankruptcy in February of 2009, the Society of Jesus Oregon Province was able to avoid a trial and protect much of their assets. But the attorney for the province says that's not the case.
In fact, the Oregon Province worked very closely with the attorneys for the victims to come up with a formula to equitably distribute the proceeds of the settlement.
That's attorney Howard Levine, who represented the province. Levine says they filed for bankruptcy to recover money from insurance carriers and to fairly distribute it to victims. Levine is the only one the province made available for an interview, but in a press release attributed to Provincial Superior Patrick Lee, the province apologized for the pain and hurt caused by the men that perpetrated the abuse. The payments to those victims start as the order finalized its emergence from Chapter 11 bankruptcy, which Levine says will allow the Jesuits to focus on their mission.
The Oregon province's energies support various works in education, spiritual formation, parish work, and other assignments that are dedicated to social justice. And by coming out of Chapter 11, the Oregon province is able to dedicate itself to fulfilling its mission to help others.
The settlement comes with several non-monetary provisions, which calls for the province to, among other things, write letters of apologies to the victims and implement a policy for reporting sexual abuse. The settlement also created a future claims fund for any victims that were abused before 2009, but that have yet to come forward. Rosa says that fund holds $7 million.
There is not an unlimited amount of money in that fund, and when the money is gone, then there will be no further compensation available.
According to Rosa, the Oregon province itself paid about $43 million towards the victims' compensation, with another $120 million coming from their insurance. He says victims will receive their compensation in checks being mailed this week and a larger check in the near future. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Chelista Corporation announced late Wednesday that its last two weeklies, the Tundra Drums newspaper and the Seward Phoenix Log, have been purchased. KYUK's Angela Denning Barnes reports.
For the last 15 years, Edgar Blatchford has been an associate professor of journalism at the University of Alaska. He holds both a master's degree in journalism and a law degree. But his Alaska resume goes much further back. He's been a two-time Alaska commissioner, commissioner of commerce under Frank Murkowski, and the commissioner of community and regional affairs under Walter Hickel. And Blatchford has been the chairman and the director of Chugach Alaska Corporation. So why does he want to own a few weekly newspapers?
I'm very concerned about some of the social issues facing Alaska, the social, economic, political type issues. And I think there's a need that those issues be covered by local journalists.
This won't be the first time that Blatchford has been in the paper-owning business. He bought the Seward Phoenix Log in 1984 and founded Alaska Newspapers Incorporated in 1989 with Chilista. Soon afterward, ANI purchased the Tender Drums. Both papers have deep roots in the communities they serve. The Tender Drums has been printed for readers in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta since 1974. The Seward Phoenix Log was founded in 1966, during a time that Blatchford describes as the recovery period after the 1964 earthquake, which destroyed parts of the community. He says it played an important role in gathering public opinion and rallying the local citizens to move forward.
The Seward Phoenix Log has a history of being a cheerleader and also a newspaper that's not afraid to scold local people for doing something that may not be totally correct.
Knowing the long history of both publications, Blatchford says some things will stay the same. He wants both papers to stay local, with local journalists telling local stories. To that end, he wants to move the Tender Drums back to Bethel from Anchorage, where it has been headquartered in recent years. He says another change could be found within the news in the coming months. He wants the papers to take a stand on issues that others are reluctant to pursue.
A newspaper has that job of being objective. It has to be objective. It has to report on the issues. It cannot be just, you know, good news type newspaper.
Blatchford says he knows it's difficult for papers to turn a profit these days. That's why Chilista decided to liquidate its six weeklies. But he says he's comfortable just breaking even. The other four ANI weekly papers have already sold. The Cordova Times was purchased by its editor, Jennifer Gibbons. The Arctic Sounder, the Dutch Harbor Fisherman, and the Bristol Bay Times were purchased by husband and wife, Jason Evans and Kiana Peacock. The final publications by ANI were printed this week, and the ANI offices will close August 31st. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
The Alaska Supreme Court decided late yesterday to let a vote on the Save Our Salmon initiative go ahead in the Lake and Peninsula Borough. The initiative could limit or stop the development of Pebble Mine. KDLG's Daisha Eaton reports.
The High Court's decision allows the Lake and Peninsula Borough to vote on a citizens' initiative designed to stop the development of Pebble Mine. Lamar Cotton, the borough's manager, says his administration is moving ahead with preparations for the election.
We have always taken the attitude that we're going to hold the election, so we have not stopped or altered any of our activities to, in fact, hold the election in October. That way we can do our job, which is to hold a fair and well-managed election and let the public decide.
The public will decide on the Save Our Salmon, or SOS, initiative, which was introduced by the citizen group Alaskans for Bristol Bay back in March. If passed, the initiative would add language to the borough's permitting code to protect salmon and salmon habitat from development, and it would be a roadblock to the Pebble Partnership, slowing down or stopping them from getting the permits they need from the borough to build a giant gold and copper mine at the headwaters of Bristol Bay. The Pebble Partnership took its case against the Lake and Peninsula Borough to the Supreme Court August 1st, after the lower court ruled the vote could go forward. Art Hackney with Alaskans for Bristol Bay says he's satisfied with the court's decision, but the partnership's attack of the initiative guarantees a battle is ahead.
I have no doubt that Pebble Partnership will sue up a storm when this is over. They've certainly shown their true colors in this action that they've taken after saying that they didn't want to do anything without the support of the people of the region.
The effort by the citizens in the Lake and Peninsula Borough is just the latest in several attempts to stop or slow down the development of the Pebble deposit. Mike Heatwell is a spokesperson for the Pebble Partnership. He says the Parnell administration's concerns about the case are valid, and the High Court's decision not to review the case now just sets the stage for more litigation down the road.
Essentially, the Supreme Court, what we had brought to their attention was predominantly a timing issue, and they chose not to
act on that. What ultimately remains is that there's still significant uncertainty on the substantive matters pertaining to this ordinance. It's largely unenforceable. There's a lot of inconsistencies within the drafting of it. And that uncertainty is unfortunate as you go into now an election.
An election that could be largely for show, Heedwell says, because there's not yet been a ruling on the merits of the original case in the lower court. That judge postponed his decision on the validity of the initiative until after it goes before the voters. The citizens of the Lake and Peninsula Borough will get to cast their ballots on the Save Our Salmon Initiative October 4th. And after so much controversy, people across the state will be paying attention to what they say. In Dillingham, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
The Anchorage-based South Central Foundation has received a $700,000 federal grant to find more Alaska Native children who need to enroll in the Denali Kid Care program. That's the state program that combines with federal programs to offer medical services to children from low-income families. The federal grant was part of a $40 million national distribution, the second round of grants since the Children's Health Insurance Program was reauthorized 2 years ago. Cindy Mann with the Center for Medicaid Services says the outreach services have been successful.
A study by the Urban Institute released just this morning found that states have been making great progress. Between 2008 and 2009, even though the total number of eligible children increased, in part due to the economy, so we had a greater number of kids who were actually eligible and uninsured, the number of children who are not enrolled and who are uninsured actually dropped during this difficult economic time.
The federal emphasis on getting new clients will focus on using technology and schools to find eligible children and to focus on teenagers who still qualify for medical assistance. The new state crime lab under construction in Anchorage is almost a year away from completion, but recently a first group of staff members toured their future workspaces. KSKA's Len Anderson joined them and filed this report.
Steve Palmer, a member of the chemistry section, smiles broadly as he stands before his future work area.
I think it's going to serve our purposes. It's well planned out. We definitely have people who put a lot of time into planning for this. The hoods are going to be very quiet and efficient, and we'll be able to talk to our coworkers and not have the roar of the old hoods.
And the amount of workspace that each individual has?
It's perfect. It's ideal.
Palmer's new laboratory will be about four times larger than his current one. That 4-to-1 ratio pretty much matches the overall facility increase. Oren Dim, forensic laboratory manager, says a crime lab team that serves the entire state needs the space.
When you do pass by it on the outside, people look and say, well, that's a big building. It's a big building, but when you think about putting nine laboratories inside that building, each laboratory itself is appropriately sized. Each room just is an expanded version of what you saw in the old laboratory. Exactly. We're decompressing. We're about twice as many people as should be in that facility, so when you walk into these rooms, you see that instant expansion of space, which will be adequately filled the day we move in.
For several years, the State Crime Lab has struggled with a lack of space as both scientific advances and new laws have added to their workload. For example, what was once its simple blood type laboratory in the 80s has evolved into a lab performing sophisticated DNA forensic examinations. Besides current cases, cold case evidence is re-examined if a new scientific advancement might produce previously undisclosed clues. And by law, all evidence in sexual assault cases for the entire state has to be kept for 50 years. That's the crime lab's job. Dim says all the lab sections will benefit from the increased space. During the tour, he compared the new versus old firearms section.
The closet where we have all our weapons stored and we're capped at about 1,200 capacity, this room will enable a capacity of about 10,000 weapons, high-density shelving, so we can go back to building that reference collection.
Dim says a large firearms collection is crucial in cases hinging on the functioning of a particular gun. A huge challenge in the current lab is preserving the integrity of the evidence collected, something crucial to the investigation and the court. To assure quality in such a cramped environment, speed often has to be sacrificed. Dim says that's caused police departments to submit only their most important and immediate cases.
What we see agencies doing is going, wow, you know, if I send this, the five homicides I have there might not get worked. So they're triaging what they send to the lab. So one, you're trying to gauge what is the unmet backlog, what's the unsubmitted backlog that folks are waiting to submit because they don't want to backlog their what they deem more important cases.
With the new larger crime laboratory, cases will be processed more promptly, and that, Dim says, will encourage police departments to begin submitting all their cases needing the lab's forensic scientists. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
A humpback whale calf has been disentangled from fishing gear near Juneau. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration spokesperson Julie Spiegel says the calf and its mother were spotted Wednesday morning by a charter fishing boat near Halibut Cove. She says the five-person disentanglement team attached a transmitter to track the calf in case it raced away before they could free it.
Mama was nearby, and she was very protective of her calf throughout this whole operation. At times, she tried to position herself between the rescuers and the calf, just trying to protect her calf.
The calf was freed from the fishing lines Wednesday evening just west of Berners Bay. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson and Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Tasha Eaton in Dillingham, Len Anderson in Anchorage, and Matt Miller in Juneau. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Check the status of your application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for placing half in a college savings account and to add or change charitable donations. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska. Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. AlaskaPublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.